Chapter 27. What time are you meeting your friend? I asked.
7 o'clock, after rehearsal.
Kathy handed me her coffee cup. If you can't remember her name, Theo, it's Nicole.
Right, I said with a yawn.
Kathy gave me a stern look. You know, it's a little insulting that you don't remember. She's one of my best friends. You went to her going away party, for fuck's sake. Of course I remember Nicole. I just forgot her name, that's all.
Kathy rolled her eyes.
Whatever, pothead. I'm having a shower, she said, and walked out of the kitchen. I smiled to myself. 7 o'clock. At 6:45, I walked along the river towards Kathy's rehearsal space on the south bank. I sat on a bench across the way from the rehearsal room, facing away from the entrance so Kathy wouldn't immediately see me if she left early. Every so often I turned my head and glanced over my shoulder, but the door remained obstinately shut. And then, at 7:05, it opened. There was the sound of animated conversation and laughter as the actors left the building. They wandered out in groups of 2 or 3, no sign of Kathy. I waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and the trickle of people stopped and no one else came out. I must have missed her. She must have left before I arrived. Unless, of course, she hadn't been here at all. Had she been lying about the rehearsal? I got up and made my way towards the entrance. I needed to be sure. If she was still inside and saw me, what then? What excuse could I have for being there? I'd come to surprise her. Yes, I'd say I was here to take her and Nicole out for dinner, and Kathy would squirm and lie her way out of it with some bullshit excuse. Nicole was sick, Nicole had cancelled, and so Kathy and I would end up spending an uncomfortable evening alone together. Another evening of long silences. I reached the entrance. I hesitated, grabbed the rusted green handle, and pushed open the door. I went inside. It was a bare concrete interior. It smelled damp. Kathy's rehearsal space was on the 4th floor. She had moaned about having to climb the stairs every day, so I went up the main central staircase. I reached the 1st floor and was starting for the 2nd when I heard a voice on the stairs coming from the floor above. It was Kathy. She was on the phone. I know, I'm sorry, I'll see you soon, I won't be long, okay, bye. I froze. We were seconds away from colliding with each other, and then I dashed down the steps, hiding around the corner. Kathy walked past without seeing me. She went out the door. It slammed shut. I hurried after her and left the building. Kathy was walking away, moving fast, towards the bridge. I followed, weaving between commuters and tourists, trying to keep a distance without losing sight of her. She crossed the bridge and went down the steps into Embankment Tube Station. I went after her, wondering which line she would take, but she didn't get on the tube. Instead, she walked straight through the station and out the other side. She continued walking towards Charing Cross Road. I followed. I stood a few steps behind her at the traffic lights. Then we crossed Charing Cross Road and headed into Soho. I followed her along the narrow streets. She took a right turn, then a left, then another right, then she abruptly stopped. She stood on the corner of Lexington Street and waited. So this was the meeting place. A good spot, central, busy, anonymous. I hesitated and slipped into a pub on the corner. I positioned myself at the bar. It offered a clear view through the window of Kathy across the road. The barman, bored, with an unruly beard, glanced at me.
A pint, Guinness.
He yawned and went to the other side of the bar to pour the pint. I kept my eyes on Kathy. I was pretty sure she wouldn't be able to see me through the window, even if she looked in this direction. At one point, Kathy did look over, straight at me. My heart stopped for a second. I was sure she had noticed me, but no, her gaze drifted on. The minutes passed, and still Kathy waited. So did I. I sipped my pint slowly. Watching. He was taking his time, whoever he was. She wouldn't like that. Kathy didn't like to be kept waiting, even though she was perpetually late. I could see she was getting annoyed, frowning and checking her watch. And then a man crossed the road towards her. In the few seconds he took to cross the street, I had already sized him up and assessed him. He was well built. He had shoulder-length fair hair, which surprised me, as Kathy always said she only went for men with dark hair and eyes like mine. unless, of course, that was another lie. But the man walked right past her. She didn't even look at him. Soon he was out of sight, so it wasn't him. I wondered if Kathy and I were both thinking the same thing. Had she been stood up? And then her eyes widened. She smiled. She waved across the street at someone out of sight. At last, I thought, it's him. I craned my neck to see. And to my surprise, a tarty-looking blonde, about 30, wearing an impossibly short skirt and improbably high heels, tottered over to Kathy. I recognized her at once. Nicole. They greeted each other with hugs and kisses. They walked off, talking and laughing, arm in arm. So Kathy hadn't been lying about meeting Nicole. I registered my emotions with shock. I ought to have been hugely relieved that Kathy had been telling the truth. I ought to have been grateful. But I wasn't. I was disappointed. Chapter 28.
Well, what do you think, Alicia? Lots of light, eh? Do you like it?
Yuri showed off the new studio proudly. It had been his idea to commandeer the unused room next to the goldfish bowl, and I agreed. It seemed a better idea than sharing Rowena's art therapy room, which, given her obvious hostility, would have created difficulties. Now Alicia could have a room of her own, free to paint whenever she wished and without interruption. Alicia looked around. Her easel had been unpacked and set up by the window, where there was the most light. Her box of oils was open on a table. Yuri winked at me as Alicia approached the table. He was enthusiastic about this painting scheme, and I was grateful for his support. Yuri was a useful ally, as he was by far the most popular member of staff, with the patients anyway. He gave me a nod, saying, "Good luck, you're on your own now." Then he left. The door closed after him with a bang, but Alicia didn't seem to hear it. She was in her own world, bent over the table, examining her paints with a small smile on her face. She picked up the sable brushes and stroked them as if they were delicate flowers. She unpacked three tubes of oils, Prussian blue, Indian yellow, cadmium red, and lined them up. Then she turned to the blank canvas on the easel. She considered it. She stood there for a long time. She seemed to enter some kind of trance, a reverie. Her mind was elsewhere, having escaped somehow, travelled far beyond this cell, until finally she came out of it and turned back to the table. She squeezed some white paint onto the palette and combined it with a small amount of red. She had to mix the paints with a paintbrush. Her palette knives had been immediately confiscated upon arrival at the Grove by Stephanie, for obvious reasons. Alicia lifted the brush to the canvas and made a mark, a single red stroke of paint in the middle of the white space. She considered it for a moment, and then made another mark, and another. Soon she was painting without pause or hesitation, with total fluidity of movement. It was a kind of dance between Alicia and the canvas. I stood there, watching the shapes she was creating. I remained silent, scarcely daring to breathe. I felt like I was present at an intimate moment, watching a wild animal give birth. And although Alicia was aware of my presence, she didn't seem to mind. She occasionally looked up while painting and glanced at me, almost as if she were studying me. Over the next few days, the painting slowly started to take shape, roughly at first, sketchily, but with increasing clarity. Then it emerged from the canvas with a burst of photorealistic, pristine brilliance. Alicia had painted a red brick building, a hospital, unmistakably the Grove. It was on fire, burning to the ground. Two figures were discernible on the fire escape, a man and a woman escaping the fire. The woman was unmistakably Alicia, her red hair the same colour as the flames. I recognized the man as myself. I was carrying Alicia in my arms, holding her aloft while the fire licked at my ankles. I couldn't tell if I were depicted in the act of rescuing Alicia or about to throw her in the flames. Chapter 29.
This is ridiculous, she said. I've been coming here for years, and nobody ever told me to call ahead before. I can't stand around waiting all day. I'm an extremely busy person.
An American woman was standing by the reception desk, complaining loudly to Stephanie Clark. I recognized Barbie Hellman from the newspapers and TV coverage of the murder. She was Alicia's neighbor in Hampstead, who heard the gunshots the night of Gabriel's murder and phoned the police. Barbie was a Californian blonde in her mid-60s, possibly older. She was drenched in Chanel No. 5, and she'd had a considerable amount of plastic surgery. Her name suited her. She looked like a startled Barbie doll. She was obviously the kind of woman who was used to getting what she wanted, hence her loud protestations at the reception desk when she discovered she needed to make an appointment to visit a patient.
"Let me talk to the manager," she said, with a grand gesture as if this were a restaurant instead of a psychiatric unit. "This is absurd. Where is he?"
"I am the manager, Mrs. Hellman," said Stephanie. "We've met before."
This was the first time I felt even vaguely sympathetic to Stephanie. It was hard not to pity her for being on the receiving end of Barbie's onslaught. Barbie talked a lot and talked fast, leaving no pauses, giving her opponent no time to respond.
"Well, you never mentioned anything about making appointments before," Barbie laughed loudly. "For Christ's sake, it's easier to get a table at the Ivy."
I joined them and smiled at Stephanie innocently. "Can I help?" Stephanie shot me an irritated look.
"No, thanks, I can manage."
Barbie looked me up and down with some interest.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Theo Faber, Alicia's therapist."
"Oh, really?" Barbie said. "How interesting."
Therapists were obviously something she could relate to, unlike ward managers. From then on, she deferred solely to me, treating Stephanie as if she were nothing more than a receptionist, which I must admit rather wickedly amused me.
"You must be new if we've not met," Barbie said.
I opened my mouth to reply, but she got there first.
"I usually come every couple of months or so. I left it a bit longer this time as I've been in the States seeing my family, but as soon as I got back, I thought I must visit my Alicia. I miss her so much. Alicia was my best friend, you know."
"No, I didn't know."
"Oh, yeah, when they moved in next door, I was a great help in getting Alicia and Gabriel settled into the neighborhood. Alicia and I became extremely close. We'd confide in each other about everything."
"I see." Yuri appeared in the reception and I beckoned him over.
"Mrs. Hellman is here to see Alicia," I said.
"Call me Barbie, honey. Yuri and I are old friends," she said, winking at Yuri. "We go way back. He's not the problem. It's this lady here."
She gestured dismissively at Stephanie, who finally found an opportunity to speak.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Hellman," Stephanie said, "but hospital policy has changed since you were here last year. We've tightened our security. From now on, you'll have to call before..."
"Oh, God, do we have to go through this again? I'll scream if I have to hear it one more time, as if life weren't complicated enough."
Stephanie gave up, and Yuri led Barbie off. I followed. We entered the visitor's room and waited for Alicia. It was a bare room, a table and two chairs, no windows, and a sickly yellow fluorescent light. I stood at the back and watched Alicia appear at the other door, accompanied by two nurses. Alicia didn't betray any obvious reaction to seeing Barbie. She walked over to the table and sat down without looking up. Barbie, on the other hand, seemed much more emotional.
"Alicia, darling, I've missed you. You're so thin, there's nothing left of you. I'm so jealous. How are you? That awful woman nearly didn't let me see you. It's been a nightmare."
And so it went on, an endless stream of inane chatter from Barbie, details of her trip to San Diego to visit her mother and brother. Alicia just sat there, silent, her face a mask, betraying nothing, showing nothing. After about 20 minutes, the monologue mercifully ended. Alicia was led away by Yuri, as uninterested as she was when she had entered. I approached Barbie as she was leaving the grove.
"Can I have a word?" I said.
Barbie nodded, as if she had been expecting this.
You want to talk to me about Alicia? It's about time somebody asked me some goddamn questions. The police didn't want to hear anything, which was crazy, because Alicia confided in me all the time, you know, about everything. She told me things you wouldn't believe. Bobby said this with a definite emphasis and gave me a coy smile. She knew she had piqued my interest. "Such as?" I said. Bobby smiled cryptically and pulled on her fur coat. "Well, I can't go into it here. I'm late enough as it is. Come over this evening, say 6 p.m.? I didn't relish the prospect of visiting Barbie at her house. I sincerely hoped Diomedes wouldn't find out, but I had no choice. I wanted to find out what she knew. I forced a smile. "What's your address?" Chapter 30. Barbie's house was one of several across the road from Hampstead Heath, overlooking one of the ponds. It was large and, given its location, probably fantastically overpriced. Barbie had lived in Hampstead for several years before Gabriel and Alicia moved in next door. Her ex-husband was an investment banker and had commuted between London and New York until they divorced. He found himself a younger, blonder version of his wife, and Barbie got the house. "So everyone was happy," she said with a laugh, "particularly me." Barbie's house was painted pale blue, in contrast to the other houses on the street, which were white. Her front garden was decorated with little trees and potted plants. Barbie greeted me at the door. "Hi, honey, I'm glad you're on time. That's a good sign. This way." I followed her through the hallway to the living room. The house smelled like a greenhouse. It was full of plants and flowers, roses, lilies, orchids, everywhere you looked. Paintings, mirrors, and framed photographs were crammed together on the walls. Little statues, vases, and other objets d'art competed for space on tables and dressers. All expensive items, but crammed together like this, they looked like junk. Taken as a representation of Barbie's mind, it suggested a disordered inner world, to say the least. It made me think of chaos, clutter, greed, insatiable hunger. I wondered what her childhood had been like. I shifted a couple of tasseled cushions to make room and sat on the large, uncomfortable sofa. Barbie opened a drinks cabinet and pulled out a couple of glasses. "Now, what do you want to drink? You look like a whiskey drinker to me. My ex-husband drank a gallon of whiskey a day. He said he needed it to put up with me." She laughed. "I'm a wine connoisseur, actually. I went on a course in the Bordeaux region in France. I have an excellent nose." She paused for breath, and I took the opportunity to speak while I had the chance. "I don't like whiskey. I'm not much of a drinker, just the odd beer, really." "Oh," Barbie looked rather annoyed. "I don't have any beer." "Well, that's fine. I don't need a drink." "Well, I do, honey. It's been one of those days." Barbie poured herself a large glass of red wine and curled up in the armchair like she was settling in for a good chat. "I'm all yours," she said with a flirtatious smile. "What do you want to know?" "I have a couple of questions, if that's all right." "Well, fire away." "Did Alicia ever mention seeing a doctor?" "A doctor?" She seemed surprised by the question. "You mean a shrink?" "No, I mean a medical doctor." "Oh, well, I don't..." Barbie trailed off and hesitated. "Actually, now you mention it, yes, there was someone she was seeing. Do you know the name?" "No, I don't. But I remember I told her about my doctor, Dr. Monks, who's just incredible. He only has to look at you to see what's wrong with you straight away, and he tells you exactly what to eat. It's amazing." There followed a long and complicated explanation of the dietary requirements demanded by Barbie's doctor, and an insistence I pay him a visit soon. I was starting to lose patience. It took some effort to get her back on track. "You saw Alicia on the day of the murder?" "Yes, just a few hours before it happened." She paused to gulp some more wine. "I went over to see her. I used to pop over all the time for coffee. Well, she drank coffee. I usually took a bottle of something. We'd talk for hours. We were so close, you know." "So you keep saying," I thought. But I had already diagnosed Barbie as almost entirely narcissistic. I doubted she was able to relate to others except as a function of her own needs. I imagined Alicia didn't do much talking during these visits. "How would you describe her mental state that afternoon?" Barbie shrugged. "She seemed fine. She had a bad headache, that was all. She wasn't on edge at all.
Should she be? Well, given the circumstances. Barbie gave me an astonished look. You don't think she was guilty, do you? She laughed. Oh, honey, I thought you were smarter than that. I'm afraid I don't... Alicia was no way tough enough to kill anyone. She wasn't a killer. Take it from me, she's innocent. I'm 100% sure. I'm curious how you can be so positive given the evidence. I don't give a shit about that. I've got my own evidence. You do? You bet. But first, I need to know if I can trust you. Barbie's eyes searched mine hungrily. I met her gaze steadily, and then she came out with it just like that. You see, there was a man. A man, yes, watching. I was a little taken aback and immediately alert. What do you mean, watching? Just what I said, watching. I told the police, but they didn't seem interested. They made up their minds the moment they found Alicia with Gabriel's body and the gun. They didn't want to listen to any other story. What story, exactly? I'll tell you, and you'll see why I wanted you to come over tonight. It's worth hearing. Just get on with it, I thought, but I said nothing and smiled encouragingly. She refilled her glass. It started a couple of weeks before the murder. I went over to see Alicia, and we had a drink, and I noticed she was quieter than usual, and I said, "Are you okay?" And she started crying. I had never seen her like that before. She was crying her eyes out. She was normally so reserved, you know, but that day she just let go. She was a mess, honey, a real mess. What did she say? She asked me if I'd noticed anyone hanging around in the neighborhood. She'd seen a man on the street watching her. Bobby hesitated. I'll show you. She texted this to me. Her manicured hands stretched for her phone, and she searched through her photos on it. She thrust the phone at my face. I stared at it. It took me a second to make sense of what I was seeing. A blurred photograph of a tree. What is it? What does it look like? A tree? Behind the tree. Behind the tree, there was a grey blob. It could have been anything from a lamppost to a large dog. It's a man, she said. You can see his outline quite distinctly. I wasn't convinced, but didn't argue. I didn't want Barbie to get distracted. Keep going, I said. That's it. But what happened? Barbie shrugged. Nothing. I told Alicia to tell the cops, and that was when I found out she hadn't even told her husband about it. She hadn't told Gabriel, why not? I don't know, I got the feeling he wasn't all that sympathetic a person. Anyway, I insisted she tell the police. I mean, what about me? What about my safety? A prowler's outside, and I'm a woman living alone, you know? I want to feel safe when I go to bed at night. Did Alicia follow your advice? Barbie shook her head. No, she did not. A few days later, she told me she talked it over with her husband and decided she was imagining it all. She told me to forget it and asked me not to mention it to Gabriel if I saw him. I don't know. The whole thing stank to me. And she asked me to delete the photo. I didn't. I showed it to the police when she was arrested, but they weren't interested. They'd already made up their minds. But I'm positive there's more to it. Can I tell you... She lowered her voice to a dramatic whisper. Alicia was scared. Barbie left a dramatic pause, finishing her wine. She reached for the bottle. Sure you don't want a drink? I refused again, thanked her, made my excuses, and left. There was no point in staying further. She had nothing else to tell me. I had more than enough to think about. It was dark when I left her house. I paused a moment outside the house next door. Alicia's old house. It had been sold soon after the trial, and a Japanese couple lived there. They were, according to Barbie, most unfriendly. She had made several advances which they had resisted. I wondered how I'd feel if Barbie lived next door to me, endlessly popping over. I wondered how Alicia felt about her. I lit a cigarette and thought about what I had just heard. So Alicia told Barbie she was being watched. The police had presumably thought Barbie was attention-seeking and making it up, which was why they had ignored her story. I wasn't surprised. Barbie was hard to take seriously. It meant that Alicia had been scared enough to appeal to Barbie for help and afterwards to Gabriel. What then? Did Alicia confide in someone else? I needed to know. I had a sudden image of myself as a child, a little boy close to bursting point with anxiety, holding in all my terrors, all my pain, pacing endlessly, restless, scared, alone with the fears of my crazy father. No one to tell, no one who'd listen. Alicia must have felt similarly desperate, or she'd never have confided in Barbie. I shivered and sensed a pair of eyes on the back of my head. I spun round, but there was no one there. I was alone. The street was empty, shadowy and silent. Chapter 31. I arrived at the Grove the next morning, intending to talk to Alicia about what Barbie had told me, but as soon as I entered the reception, I heard a woman screaming, howls of agony echoing along the corridors. "What is it? What's going on?" The security guard ignored my questions. He ran past me into the ward. I followed him. The screams grew louder as I approached. I hoped Alicia was okay, that she wasn't involved, but somehow I had a bad feeling. I turned the corner. A crowd of nurses, patients, and security staff were gathered outside the goldfish bowl. Diomedes was on the phone, calling for paramedics. His shirt was spattered with blood, but not his blood. Two nurses were kneeling on the floor, assisting a screaming woman. The woman was not Alicia. It was Elif. Elif was writhing, screaming in agony, clutching at her bloody face. Her eye was gushing blood. Something was sticking out of her eye socket, plunged into the eyeball. It looked like a stick. But it wasn't a stick. I knew at once what it was. It was a paintbrush. Alicia was standing by the wall, being restrained by Yuri and another nurse, but no physical restraint was necessary. She was totally calm, perfectly still, like a statue. Her expression reminded me sharply of the painting, the Alcestis. Blank, expressionless, empty. She stared straight at me. And for the first time, I felt afraid. Chapter 32. "How is Elif?" I asked. I was waiting in the goldfish bowl and caught Yuri once he returned from the emergency ward. "Stable," he said, with a heavy sigh, "which is about the best we can hope for. I'd like to see her. Elif or Alicia?" "Elif first." Yuri nodded. "They want her to rest tonight, but in the morning I'll take you to her." "What happened? Were you there? I presume Alicia was provoked." Yuri sighed again and shrugged. "I don't know. Elif was hanging around outside Alicia's studio. There must have been a confrontation of some kind. I've no idea what they were fighting about." "Have you got the key? Let's go and have a look, see if we can find any clues." We left the goldfish bowl and walked to Alicia's studio. Yuri unlocked the door and opened it. He flicked on the light. And there, on the easel, was the answer we were looking for. Alicia's painting, the picture of the Grove going up in flames, had been defaced. The word "slut" was crudely daubed across it in red paint. I nodded. "Well, that explains it. You think Elif did it? Who else?" I found Elif in the emergency ward. She was propped up in bed, attached to a drip. Padded bandages were wrapped around her head, covering one eye. She was upset, angry, and in pain. "Fuck off," she said when she saw me. I pulled up a chair by the bed and sat down. I spoke gently, respectfully. "I'm sorry, Elif, truly sorry. This is an awful thing to happen. A tragedy."
"Too fucking right. Now piss off and leave me alone."
"Tell me what happened."
"That bitch took out my fucking eye, that's what happened."
"Why did she do that? Did you have a fight?"
"You trying to blame me? I didn't do nothing."
"I'm not trying to blame you. I just want to understand why she did it."
Because she got a fucking screw loose, that's why.
It had nothing to do with the painting? I saw what you did. You defaced it, didn't you? Elif narrowed her remaining eye, then firmly closed it. That was a bad thing to do, Elif. It doesn't justify her response, but still, that ain't why she did it. Elif opened her eye and stared at me scornfully. I hesitated. No? Then why did she attack you? Elif's lips twisted into a kind of smile. She didn't speak. We sat like that for a few moments. I was about to give up when she spoke. I told her the truth, she said. What truth? That you're soft on her. I was startled by this. Before I could respond, Elif went on, speaking with cold contempt. You're in love with her, mate. I told her so. He loves you, I said. He loves you. Theo and Alicia sitting in a tree. Theo and Alicia. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. Elif started laughing, a horrible, shrieking laugh. I could picture the rest. Alicia goaded into a frenzy, spinning round, raising her paintbrush and plunging it into Elif's eye.
She's a fucking nutter!
Elif sounded close to tears, anguished, exhausted.
She's a psycho!
And looking at her bandaged wound, I couldn't help but wonder if she were right. Chapter 33. The meeting took place in Diomedes' office, but Stephanie Clark assumed control from the start. Now we had left the abstract world of psychology and entered the concrete realm of health and safety. We were under her jurisdiction, and she knew it. Judging by Diomedes' sullen silence, it was obvious so did he. Stephanie was standing with her arms crossed. Her excitement was palpable. She was getting off on this, I thought. Being in charge and having the last word. How she must have resented us all, overruling her, teaming up against her. Now she was relishing her revenge. The incident yesterday morning was totally unacceptable, she said. I warned against Alicia being allowed to paint, but I was overruled. Individual privileges always stir up jealousies and resentments. I knew something like this would happen. From now on, safety must come first. Is that why Alicia has been put in seclusion? I said, in the interest of safety. She is a threat to herself and others. She attacked Elif. She could have killed her. She was provoked. Diomedes shook his head and joined the conversation. He spoke wearily. I don't think any level of provocation justifies that kind of attack. Stephanie nodded. Precisely, she said. It was an isolated incident, I said. Putting Alicia in seclusion isn't just cruel, it's barbaric. I had seen patients subjected to seclusion in Broadmoor, locked in a tiny, windowless room, barely enough space for a bed, let alone other furniture. Hours or days in seclusion was enough to drive anyone mad, let alone someone who was already unstable. Stephanie shrugged. As manager of the clinic, I have the authority to take any action I deem necessary. I asked Christian for his guidance and he agreed with me. I bet he did. Across the room, Christian smiled smugly at me. I could also feel Diomedes watching me. I knew what they were thinking. I was letting it get personal and letting my feelings show. But I didn't care. Locking her up is not the answer. We need to keep talking to her. We need to understand. I understand perfectly, Christian said with a heavy, patronizing tone, as if he were talking to a backward child. It's you, Theo. Me? Who else? You're the one who's been stirring things up. In what sense, stirring? It's true, isn't it? You campaigned to lower her medication. I laughed. It was hardly a campaign, it was an intervention. She was drugged up to the eyeballs, a zombie. Bullshit. I turned to Diomedes. You're not seriously trying to pin this on me. Is that what's happening here? Diomedes shook his head but evaded my eye. Of course not. Nonetheless, it's obvious that her therapy has destabilized her. It's challenged her too much too soon. I suspect that's why this unfortunate event took place. I don't accept that. You're possibly too close to see it clearly. He threw up his hands and sighed, a man defeated. We can't afford any more mistakes, not at such a critical juncture. As you know, the future of the unit is at stake. Every mistake we make gives the Trust another excuse to close us down. I felt intensely irritated at his defeatism, his weary acceptance. The answer is not to drug her up and throw away the key, I said. We're not jailers. I agree, said Indira. She gave me a supportive smile and went on. The problem is, we've become so risk-averse, we'd rather over-medicate than take any chances. We need to be brave enough to sit with the madness, to hold it, instead of trying to lock it up. Christian rolled his eyes and was about to object, but Diomedes spoke first, shaking his head. It's too late for that. This is my fault. Alicia isn't a suitable candidate for psychotherapy. I should never have allowed it. Diomedes said he blamed himself, but I knew he was really blaming me. All eyes were on me. Diomedes' disappointed frown, Christian's gaze, mocking, triumphant, Stephanie's hostile stare, Indira's look of concern. I tried not to sound like I was pleading. Stop Alicia painting if you must, I said, but don't stop her therapy. It's the only way to reach her. Diomedes shook his head. I'm beginning to suspect she's unreachable. Just give me some more time. But there was a note of finality in his voice that told me there was no point in arguing further. No, Diomedes said. It's over. Chapter 34. Diomedes was wrong about the snow clouds. It didn't snow. Instead, it started raining heavily that afternoon. A storm with angry drumbeats of thunder and lightning flashes. I waited for Alicia in the therapy room, watching the rain batter the window. I felt weary and depressed. The whole thing had been a waste of time. I had lost Alicia before I could help her. Now I never would. A knock at the door. Yuri escorted Alicia into the therapy room. She looked worse than I expected. She was pale, ashen, ghost-like. The way she moved was clumsy and her right leg trembled non-stop. Fucking Christian, I thought. She was drugged out of her mind. There was a long pause after Yuri left. Alicia didn't look at me. Eventually I spoke, loudly and clearly, to make sure she understood. Alicia, I'm sorry you were put in seclusion. I'm sorry you had to go through that. No reaction. I hesitated. I'm afraid that because of what you did to Elif, our therapy has been terminated. This wasn't my decision, far from it, but there's nothing I can do about it. I'd like to offer you this opportunity to talk about what happened, to explain your attack on Elif, and express the remorse I'm sure you're feeling. Alicia said nothing. I wasn't sure my words were penetrating her medicated haze. I'll tell you how I feel, I went on. I feel angry, to be honest. I feel angry that our work is ending before we've even properly begun, and I feel angry that you didn't try harder. Alicia's head moved. Her eyes stared into mine. You're afraid. I know that, I said. I've been trying to help you, but you won't let me. And now I don't know what to do. I fell silent, defeated. And then Alicia did something I will never forget. She held out her trembling hand towards me. She was clutching something, a small leather-bound notebook. What's that? No reply. She kept holding it out. I peered at it, curious. Do you want me to take it? No response. I hesitated and gently took the notebook from her fluttering fingers. I opened it and thumbed through the pages. It was a handwritten diary. A journal. Alicia's journal. Judging by the handwriting, it was written in a chaotic state of mind, particularly the last pages, where the writing was barely legible. Arrows connecting different paragraphs written at different angles across the page, doodles and drawings taking over some pages, flowers growing into vines, covering what had been written and making it almost indecipherable. I looked at Alicia, burning with curiosity. "What do you want me to do with this?" The question was quite unnecessary. It was obvious what Alicia wanted. She wanted me to read it. Part 3. I mustn't put strangeness where there's nothing. I think that is the danger of keeping a diary. You exaggerate everything. You are on the lookout, and you continually stretch the truth. Jean-Paul Sartre. Though I am not naturally honest, I am sometimes so by chance. William Shakespeare, The Winter's Tale.
Alicia Berrington's diary. 8th of August. Something odd happened today. I was in the kitchen making coffee, looking out of the window, looking without seeing, daydreaming, and then I noticed something, or rather someone, outside. A man. I noticed him because he was standing so still, like a statue, and facing the house. He was on the other side of the road by the entrance to the heath. He was standing in the shadow of a tree. He was tall, well-built. I couldn't make out his features as he was wearing sunglasses and a cap. I couldn't tell if he could see me or not through the window, but it felt like he was staring right at me. I thought it was weird. I'm used to people waiting across the street at the bus stop, but he wasn't waiting for a bus. He was staring at the house. I realised that I had been standing there for several minutes, so I made myself leave the window. I went to the studio. I tried to paint, but couldn't concentrate. My mind kept going back to the man. I decided to give myself another 20 minutes, and then I'd go back to the kitchen and look, and if he was still there, then what? He wasn't doing anything wrong. He might be a burglar, studying the house, I suppose that was my first thought, but why just stand there like that, so conspicuously? Maybe he was thinking of moving here. Maybe he's buying the house for sale at the end of the street. That could explain it. But when I went back to the kitchen and peered out of the window, he had gone. The street was empty. I guess I'll never know what he was doing. How strange. 10th of August. I went to the play with Jean-Félix last night. Gabriel didn't want me to, but I went anyway. I was dreading it. But I thought if I gave Jean-Félix what he wanted and went with him, maybe that would be an end to this. I hoped so, anyway. We arranged to meet early, to have a drink, his idea, and when I got there it was still light. The sun was low in the sky, colouring the river blood red. Jean-Félix was waiting for me outside the National. I saw him before he saw me. He was scanning the crowds, scowling. If I had any doubt I was doing the right thing, seeing his angry face dispelled it. I was filled with a horrible kind of dread, and nearly turned and bolted. But he turned and saw me before I could. He waved and I went over to him. I pretended to smile, and so did he. "I'm so glad you came," Jean-Félix said. "I was worried you wouldn't show up. Shall we go in and have a drink?" We had a drink in the foyer. It was awkward, to say the least. Neither of us mentioned the other day. We talked a lot about nothing, or rather Jean-Félix talked and I listened. We ended up having a couple of drinks. I hadn't eaten and I felt a bit drunk. I think that was probably Jean-Félix's intention. He was trying his best to engage me, but the conversation was stilted. It was orchestrated, stage-managed. Everything that came out of his mouth seemed to start with, "Wasn't it fun when," or, "Do you remember that time we..." Like he'd rehearsed little reminiscences in the hope they'd weaken my resolve and remind me how much history we had, how close we were. What he doesn't seem to realise is I've made my decision. And nothing he can say now would change that. In the end, I'm glad I went. Not because I saw Jean-Félix, because I saw the play. Alcestis isn't a tragedy I've heard of. I suppose it's obscure because it's a smaller kind of domestic story, which is why I liked it so much. It was staged in the present day, in a small suburban house in Athens. I liked the scale of it. An intimate kitchen sink tragedy. A man is condemned to die and his wife, Alcestis, wants to save him. The actress playing Alcestis looked like a Greek statue. She had a wonderful face. I kept thinking about painting her. I thought about getting her details and contacting her agent. I nearly mentioned it to Jean-Félix, but I stopped myself. I don't want to involve him in my life anymore on any level. I had tears in my eyes at the end. Alcestis dies and is reborn. She literally comes back from the dead. There's something there that I need to think about. I'm not sure exactly what yet. Of course, Jean-Félix had all kinds of reactions to the play, but none of them really resonated with me, so I tuned him out and stopped listening. I couldn't get Alcestis' death and resurrection out of my mind. I kept thinking about it as we walked back across the bridge to the station. Jean-Félix asked if I wanted to have another drink, but I said I was tired. There was another awkward pause. We stood outside the entrance to the station. I thanked him for the evening and said it had been fun. Just have one more drink, Jean-Félix said. One more for old time's sake. No, I should go. I tried to leave, and he grabbed my hand.
Alicia, he said.
Listen to me, I need to tell you something. No, please don't, there's nothing to say, really. Just listen, it's not what you think. And he's right, it wasn't. I was expecting Jean-Félix to plead for our friendship or try and make me feel guilty for leaving the gallery, but what he said took me totally by surprise. You need to be careful, he said. You're way too trusting. The people around you, you trust them. Don't trust them. I stared at him blankly. It took me a second to speak. What are you talking about? Who do you mean? Jean-Félix just shook his head and didn't say anything. He let go of my hand and walked off. I called after him, but he didn't stop. Jean-Félix, stop! He didn't look back. I watched him disappear around the corner. I stood there, rooted to the spot. I didn't know what to think. What was he doing, making a mysterious warning and then walking off like that? I guess he wanted to get the upper hand and leave me feeling unsure and wrong-footed, and he succeeded. He also left me feeling angry. Now, in a way, he's made it easy for me. Now I'm determined to cut him out of my life. What does he mean about people around me? Presumably that means Gabriel. But why? No. I'm not doing this. This is exactly what Jean-Félix wanted, to fuck with my head. Get me obsessing about him. Come between me and Gabriel. I won't fall for it. I won't give it another thought. I went back home and Gabriel was in bed, asleep. He had a 5 a.m. call for a shoot, but I woke him up and we had sex. I couldn't get close enough to him or feel him deeply enough in me. I wanted to be fused with him. I wanted to climb inside him and disappear. 11th of August. I saw that man again. He was a bit further away this time. He was sitting on a bench further into the heath, but it was him, I could tell. Most people are wearing shorts and t-shirts and light colours in this weather, and he was wearing a dark shirt and trousers, black sunglasses and cap, and his head was angled towards the house, looking at it. I had a funny thought. Maybe he's not a burglar, perhaps he's a painter. Perhaps he's a painter like me and he's thinking about painting the street or the house. But as soon as I thought this, I knew it wasn't true. If he really were going to paint the house, he wouldn't just be sitting there. He'd be making sketches. I got myself into a state about it and I phoned Gabriel. That was a mistake. I could tell he was busy. The last thing he needed was me calling, freaking out because I think someone's watching the house. Of course, I'm only assuming the man is watching the house. He could be watching me. 13th of August. He was there again. It was soon after Gabriel left this morning. I had a shower and saw him out of the bathroom window. He was closer this time. He was standing by the bus stop, like he was casually waiting for the bus. I don't know who he thinks he's fooling. I got dressed quickly and went into the kitchen to have a better look. But he was gone. I decided to tell Gabriel about it when he got home. I thought he'd brush it off, but he took it seriously. He seemed quite worried. Is it Jean-Félix? He said straight away. No, of course not. How can you even think that?
I tried to sound surprised and indignant, but in truth I had wondered that too. The man and Jean-Félix are the same build. It could be Jean-Félix, but even so, I just don't want to believe it. He wouldn't try and frighten me like that, would he? What's Jean-Félix's number? Gabriel said. I'm calling him right now. Darling, don't. Please. I'm sure it's not him. Positive? Absolutely. Nothing happened. I don't know why I'm making such a big deal out of it. It's nothing. How long was he there for? Not long, an hour or so, and then he vanished. What do you mean, vanished? He just disappeared. Uh-huh. Is there any chance you could be imagining this? Something about the way he said that annoyed me. I'm not imagining it. I need you to believe me. I do believe you. But I could tell he didn't totally believe me. He only partly believed me. Part of him was just humoring me. Which makes me angry, if I'm honest. So angry, I have to stop here, or I might write something I'll regret. 14th of August. I jumped out of bed as soon as I woke up. I checked the window, hoping the man would be there again, so Gabriel could see him too, but there was no sign of him. So I felt even more stupid. This afternoon, I decided to go for a walk, despite the heat. I wanted to be on the heath, away from the buildings and roads and other people, and be alone with my thoughts. I walked up to Parliament Hill, passing the bodies of sunbathers strewn around on either side of the path. I found a bench that was unoccupied, and I sat down. I stared out at London glinting in the distance. While I was there, I was conscious the whole time of something. I kept looking over my shoulder but couldn't see anyone. But someone was there, the whole time. I could feel it. I was being watched. On my way back, I walked past the pond. I happened to look up. And there he was, the man. He was standing across the water on the other side, too far away to see clearly. But it was him. I knew it was him. He was standing perfectly still, motionless, staring right at me. And I felt an icy shiver of fear, and I acted out of instinct.
Jean-Félix!
I shouted.
Is that you? Stop it! Stop following me!
He didn't move. I acted as fast as I could. I reached into my pocket, pulled out my phone, and took a photo of him. What good it will do, I have no idea. Then I turned and started walking quickly to the end of the pond, not letting myself look back until I reached the main path. I was scared he was going to be right behind me. I turned round, and he was gone. I hope it's not Jean-Félix, I really do. When I got home, I was feeling on edge. I drew the blinds and turned off the lights. I peered out of the window, and there he was. The man was standing on the street, staring up at me. I froze. I didn't know what to do. I nearly jumped out of my skin when someone called my name.
Alicia! Alicia, are you there?
It was that awful woman from next door, Barbie Hellman. I left the window and went to the back door and opened it. Barbie had let herself in the side gate and was in the garden, clutching a bottle of wine.
Hi, honey, she said. I saw you weren't in your studio. I wondered where you were.
I was out. I just got back.
Time for a drink?
She said this in a baby voice she sometimes uses and that I find really irritating. Actually, I should get back to work.
Just a quick one, and then I have to go. I've got my Italian class tonight. Okay?
Without waiting for a reply, she came in. She said something about how dark it was in the kitchen and started opening the blinds without asking me. I was about to stop her, but when I looked outside, there was no one on the street. The man had gone. I don't know why I told Barbie about it. I don't like her or trust her, but I was scared, I suppose, and I needed someone to talk to, and she happened to be there. We had a drink, which was unlike me, and I burst into tears. And Barbie stared at me, wide-eyed, silent for once. After I finished, she put down her bottle of wine and said, "This calls for something stronger." She poured us a couple of whiskies. "Here," she said, and gave it to me. "You need this." She was right. I needed it. I knocked it back and felt a kick from it. Now it was my turn to listen, while Barbie talked. She didn't want to scare me, she said, but it didn't sound good. "I've seen this on, like, a million TV shows. He's studying your house, okay, before he makes his move. You think he's a burglar? Barbie shrugged. Or a rapist. Does that matter? It's bad news, whatever it is. I laughed. I felt relieved and grateful that someone was taking me seriously, even if it was just Barbie. I showed her the photo on my phone, but she wasn't impressed. Text it to me so I can look at it with my glasses on. It looks like a blurry smudge to me. Tell me, have you mentioned this to your husband yet? I decided to lie. No, I said. Not yet. Barbie gave me a funny look. Why not? I don't know, I suppose I worry Gabriel might think I'm exaggerating or imagining it. Are you imagining it? No. Barbie looked pleased. If Gabriel doesn't take you seriously, we'll go to the police together. You and me. I can be very persuasive. Believe me. Thanks, but I'm sure that won't be necessary. It's already necessary. Take this seriously, honey. Promise me you'll tell Gabriel when he gets home. I nodded, but I had already decided not to say anything further to Gabriel. There was nothing to tell. I have no proof the man was following me or watching me. Barbie was right. The photo proves nothing. It was all in my imagination. That's what Gabriel will say. Best not to say anything to him at all and risk upsetting him again. I don't want to bother him. I'm going to forget all about it. 4 a.m. It's been a bad night. Gabriel came home, exhausted, at about 10. He'd had a long day and wanted to go to bed early. I tried to sleep too, but I couldn't. And then a couple of hours ago, I heard a noise. It was coming from the garden. I got up and went to the back window. I looked out. I couldn't see anyone, but I felt someone's eyes on me. Someone was watching me from the shadows. I managed to pull myself away from the window and ran to the bedroom. I shook Gabriel awake. The man is outside, I said. He's outside the house. Gabriel didn't know what I was talking about. When he understood, he started to get angry.
For Christ's sake, he said. Give it a rest. I've got to be at work in 3 hours. I don't want to play this fucking game.
It's not a game. Come and look, please. So we went to the window. And of course, the man wasn't there. There was no one there. I wanted Gabriel to go outside to check, but he wouldn't. He went back upstairs, annoyed. I tried reasoning with him, but he said he wasn't talking to me and went to sleep in the spare room. I didn't go back to bed. I've been sitting here since then, waiting, listening, alert to any sound, checking the windows. No sign of him so far. Only a couple more hours to go. It will be light soon. 15th of August. Gabriel came downstairs ready to go to the shoot. When he saw me by the window and realised I'd been up all night, he went quiet and started acting strange. Alicia, sit down, he said. We need to talk. Yes, we do need to talk about the fact that you don't believe me. I believe that you believe it. That's not the same thing. I'm not a fucking idiot. I never said you were an idiot. Then what are you saying? I thought we were about to get into a fight, so I was taken aback by what Gabriel said. He spoke in a whisper. I could barely hear him. He said, I want you to talk to someone. Please. What do you mean? A policeman?
No, Gabriel said, looking angry again. Not a policeman.
I understood what he meant, what he was saying, but I needed to hear him say it. I wanted him to spell it out. Then who?
A doctor.
I'm not seeing a doctor, Gabriel.
I need you to do this for me. You need to meet me halfway.
He said it again.
I need you to meet me halfway.
I don't understand what you mean. Halfway where? I'm right here.
No, you're not. You're not here.
He looked so tired, so upset. I wanted to protect him. I wanted to comfort him. It's okay, darling, I said. It's going to be okay. You'll see. Gabriel shook his head like he didn't believe me.
I'm going to make an appointment with Dr. West.
as soon as he can see you, today, if possible. He hesitated and looked at me. Okay. Gabriel held out his hand for mine. I wanted to slap it away, or scratch it. I wanted to bite him, or hit him, or throw him over the table and scream, "You think I'm fucking crazy, but I'm not crazy. I'm not. But I didn't do any of those things. Instead, I nodded and took Gabriel's hand and held it. Okay, darling, I said. Whatever you want. 16th of August. I went to see Dr. West today. Unwillingly, but I went. I hate him, I've decided. I hate him and his narrow house, and sitting in that weird small room upstairs, hearing his dog barking in the living room. It never stopped barking. The whole time I was there, I wanted to shout at it to shut up, and I kept thinking Dr. West would say something about it, but he acted like he couldn't hear it. Maybe he couldn't. He didn't seem to hear anything I was saying either. I told him what happened. I told him about the man watching the house and how I had seen him following me on the heath. I said all of this, but he didn't respond. He just sat there with that thin smile of his. He looked at me like I was an insect or something. I know he's supposedly a friend of Gabriel's, but I don't see how they ever could have been friends. Gabriel is so warm, and Dr. West is the opposite of warm. It's a strange thing to say about a doctor, but he has no kindness. After I finished telling him about the man, he didn't speak for ages. Silence seemed to last forever. The only sound was that dog downstairs. I started to mentally tune into the barking and go into a kind of trance. It took me by surprise when Dr. West actually spoke. "We've been here before, Alicia," he said. "Haven't we?" I looked at him blankly. I wasn't sure what he meant. "Have we?" He nodded. "Yes, we have." "I know you think I'm imagining this," I said. "I'm not imagining it. It's real." "That's what you said last time. Remember last time? Do you remember what happened?" I didn't reply. I didn't want to give him the satisfaction. I just sat there, glaring at him, like a disobedient child. Dr. West didn't wait for an answer. He kept talking, reminding me what happened after my father died, about the breakdown I suffered, the paranoid accusations that I made, the belief I was being watched, being followed and spied upon. "So you see, we've been here before, haven't we?" "But that was different. It was just a feeling. I never actually saw someone. This time I saw someone." "And who did you see?" "I already told you. A man. Describe him to me." I hesitated. "I can't." "Why not?" "I couldn't see him clearly. I told you he was too far away." "I see." "And he was in disguise. He was wearing a cap and sunglasses." "A lot of people are wearing sunglasses in this weather. And hats. Are they all in disguise?" I was starting to lose my temper. "I know what you're trying to do." "And what is that?" "You're trying to get me to admit I'm going crazy again, like after Dad died." "Is that what you think is happening?" "No. That time I was sick. This time I'm not sick. Nothing's the matter with me, apart from the fact someone is spying on me and you won't believe me." Dr. West nodded, but didn't say anything. He wrote a couple of things down in his notebook. "I'm going to put you back on medication," he said, "as a precaution. We don't want to let this get out of hand, do we?" I shook my head. "I'm not taking any pills." "I see. Well, if you refuse the medication, it's important to be aware of the consequences." "What consequences? Are you threatening me?" "It's nothing to do with me. I'm talking about your husband. How do you think Gabriel feels about what he went through last time you were unwell?" I pictured Gabriel downstairs, waiting in the living room with the barking dog. "I don't know," I said. "Why don't you ask him? Do you want him to have to go through it all again? Do you perhaps think there's a limit to how much he can take?" "What are you saying? I'll lose Gabriel. That's what you think?" Even saying it made me feel sick. The thought of losing him, I couldn't bear it. I'd do anything to keep him, even pretend I'm crazy when I know I'm not. So I gave in. I agreed to be honest with Dr. West about what I was thinking and feeling and tell him if I heard any voices. I promised to take the pills he gave me and to come back in 2 weeks for a checkup. Dr. West looked pleased. He said we could go downstairs now and rejoin Gabriel. As he went downstairs in front of me, I thought about reaching forward and shoving him down the stairs. I wish I had. Gabriel seemed much happier on the way home. He kept glancing at me as he was driving and smiling. Well done. I'm proud of you. We're going to get through this, you'll see. I nodded but didn't say anything, because of course it's bullshit. We aren't going to get through this. I'm going to have to deal with it alone. It was a mistake telling anyone. Tomorrow I'm going to tell Barbie to forget all about it. I'll say I've put it behind me and I don't want to talk about it again. She'll think I'm odd and she'll be annoyed because I'll be denying her the drama. But if I act normally, she'll soon forget all about it. As for Gabriel, I'm going to put his mind at rest. I'm going to act like everything is back to normal. I'll give a brilliant performance. I won't let my guard slip for a second. We went to the pharmacy on the way back and Gabriel got my prescription. Once we were home again, we went into the kitchen. He gave me the yellow pills with a glass of water. Take them. I'm not a child, I said. You don't need to hand them to me. I know you're not a child. I just want to make sure you'll take them and not throw them away. I'll take them. Go on then. Gabriel watched me put the pills in my mouth and sip some water. Good girl, he said, and kissed my cheek. He left the room. The moment Gabriel's back was turned, I spat out the pills. I spat them into the sink and washed them down the drain. I'm not taking any medication. The drugs Dr. West gave me last time nearly drove me crazy, and I'm not going to risk that again. I need my wits about me now. I need to be prepared. 17th of August. I've started hiding this diary. There's a loose floorboard in the spare bedroom. I'm keeping it there, out of sight, in the space underneath the floorboards. Why? Well, I'm being too honest here in these pages. It's not safe to leave it lying around. I keep imagining Gabriel stumbling across the notebook and fighting his curiosity, but then opening it and starting to read. If he found out I'm not taking the medication, he'd feel so betrayed, so hurt. I couldn't bear that. Thank God I have this diary to write in. It's keeping me sane. There's no one else I can talk to. No one I can trust. 21st of August. I've not been outside for 3 days. I've been pretending to Gabriel that I'm going for walks in the afternoons when he's out, but it's not true. It makes me fearful, the thought of going outside. I'll be too exposed. At least here in the house, I know I'm safe. I can sit by the window and monitor the passers-by. I'm scanning each face that passes for that man's face, but I don't know what he looks like. That's the problem. He could have removed his disguise and be moving about in front of me, completely unnoticed. That's an alarming thought. 22nd of August. Still no sign of him. But I mustn't lose focus. It's just a matter of time. Sooner or later, he'll be back. I need to be ready. I need to take steps. I woke up this morning and remembered Gabriel's gun. I'm going to move it from the spare room. I'll keep it downstairs where I can get to it easily. I'll put it in the kitchen cupboard, by the window. That way, it will be there if I need it. I know all this sounds crazy. I hope nothing comes of it. I hope I never see the man again. But I have a horrible feeling I will. Where is he? Why hasn't he been here? Is he trying to get me to lower my guard? I mustn't do that. I must continue my vigil by the window. Keep waiting. Keep watching. 23rd of August. I'm starting to think I imagined the whole thing. Maybe I did. Gabriel keeps asking me how I'm doing, if I'm okay. I can tell he's worried despite me insisting I'm fine. My acting doesn't seem to be convincing him anymore. I need to try harder. I pretend to be focused on work all day, whereas in fact work couldn't be further from my mind. I've lost any connection with it, any impetus to finish the paintings. As I write this, I can't honestly say I think I'll paint again. Not until all this is behind me anyway. I'd been making excuses about why I don't want to go out, but Gabriel told me tonight I had no choice. Max has asked us out to dinner. I can't think of anything worse than seeing Max. I pleaded with Gabriel to cancel, saying I needed to work, but he told me it would do me good to go. He insisted, and I could tell he meant it, so I had no choice. I gave in and said yes. I've been worrying all day about tonight, because as soon as my mind started turning on it, everything seemed to fall into place. Everything made sense. I don't know why I didn't think of it before. It's so obvious. I understand now. The man who's watching, it isn't Jean-Félix. Jean-Félix isn't dark or devious enough to do this kind of thing. Who else would want to torment me, scare me, punish me? Max. Of course it's Max. It has to be Max. He's trying to drive me crazy. I'm dreading it, but I must work up the courage somehow. I'm going to do it tonight. I'm going to confront him. 24th of August. It felt strange and a little frightening to go out last night after so long inside the house. The outside world felt huge. An empty space around me, the big sky above. I felt very small and held on to Gabriel's arm for support. Even though we went to our old favourite, Augusto's, I didn't feel safe. It didn't feel comforting or familiar like it used to. The restaurant seemed different somehow, and it smelled different. It smelled of something burning. I asked Gabriel if something was on fire in the kitchen, but he said he couldn't smell anything, that I was imagining it. Everything's fine, he said. Just calm down. I am calm, I said. Don't I seem calm? Gabriel didn't respond. He just clenched his jaw, the way he does when he's annoyed. We sat down and waited for Max in silence. Max brought his receptionist to dinner. Tanya, she's called. Apparently they've started dating. Max was acting like he was smitten with her, his hands all over her, touching her, kissing her, and all the time he kept staring at me. Did he think he was going to make me jealous? He's horrible. He makes me sick. Tanya noticed something was up. She caught Max staring at me a couple of times. I should warn her about him, really. Tell her what she's getting into. Maybe I will, but not right now. I've got other priorities at the moment. Max said he was going to the bathroom. I waited a moment, and then I seized my chance. I said I needed the bathroom too. I left the table and followed him. I caught up with Max round the corner and grabbed hold of his arm. I gripped it hard. Stop it, I said. Stop it! Max looked bemused. Stop what? You're spying on me, Max. You're watching me. I know you are. What? I have no idea what you are talking about, Alicia. Don't lie to me. I was finding it hard to control my voice. I wanted to scream. I've seen you, okay? I took a photo. I took a picture of you. Max laughed. What are you talking about? Let go of me, you crazy bitch. I slapped his face. Hard. And then I turned and saw Tanya standing there. She looked like she was the one who'd been slapped. Tanya looked from Max to me, but didn't say anything. She walked out of the restaurant. Max glared at me, and before he followed her, he hissed. I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm not fucking watching you. Now get out of my way. And the way he said it, with such anger, such contempt, I could tell Max was speaking the truth. I believed him. I didn't want to believe him, but I did. But if it's not Max, who is it? 25th of August. I just heard something. A noise outside. I checked the window and I saw someone moving in the shadows. It's the man. He's outside. I phoned Gabriel, but he didn't pick up. Should I call the police? I don't know what to do. My hand is shaking so much I can bet. I can hear him. Downstairs. He's trying the windows and the doors. He's trying to get in. I need to get out of here. I need to escape. Oh my God, I can hear him. He's inside. He's inside the house.